Time to the 50th anniversary of Rolling Stone magazine. Journalist Joe Hagan has released the new book, Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner in Rolling Stone magazine. In the book, Wenner opens up his personal and professional life to the scrutiny of a journalist for the first time. Over the course of several years, Wenner gave Hagan hours of interviews and access to his enormous archive. But in the end, he did not have approval on the material. Sticky Fingers is an independent chronicle of Wenner's life, chock full of explosive revelations. Hagan lays out the full breadth of Wenner's life, from his ambitious youth in San Francisco and the uncertain first days of Rolling Stone, to his seismic rise as a 1970s kingmaker of rock and roll and an irascible media mogul of Manhattan. Again, Joe Hagan's new book is Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner in Rolling Stone magazine, and we welcome Joe Hagan to the roundtable this morning. Joe, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
I have to say, this book is fascinating to me in many respects, but not the least of which is that when I was putting together, compiling my thoughts, I realized that I had as many questions for you about the making of this book than I had about the book itself, which is interesting to me. So I will begin with this question of what has it been like to have been working on something for so long and finally have it hit its audience?
Well, it's been incredibly intense. I mean, in addition to just joyful, because 4 years of labor and then having something come out is incredibly satisfying. At the same time, it's been obviously stressful and dramatic because, as people may or may not know, the subject of the book has been displeased with it. And so I've had to contend with that to some degree. At the same time, I believe in the book. It's the book I wanted to write. I feel really great about how it came out, and I think people will enjoy it.
The idea that Jan Wenner did not ultimately like the book, while, yes, I certainly can understand how that can be stressful and intense, it couldn't have been too much of a surprise, though, right?
I mean, Not at all.
You knew the guy enough to know that.
Yeah, that's true. And I foresaw some tension there. I didn't know what form it would take. You know, I didn't know how it was all going to play out. But in some ways, it played out maybe in a textbook way, because if you actually read the book, as you have, it's, you know, the character you meet in the book, this is exactly how he would react, right? It's, in a way, the predictability of it had a lot to do with my understanding of him.
So I think it's important for people to understand that ultimately it was Jan Wenner who asked you to write the book in 2013. He came to you first.
That's right.
So what was the tenor of that, and what was the understanding of what this project would be?
Well, it was a whole process that we went through. But he took me out to lunch in Rhinebeck, New York, one day, and the ostensible reason for the lunch was maybe I would come work at Rolling Stone magazine. At the time, I was working at New York Magazine. And he kind of sensed that I was a little reluctant to do that. And he pivoted to, how would you like to write my biography? And of course, you imagine a magazine writer. I've been in the business for almost 20 years. You know, to have somebody like Jan Wenner, the founder of Rolling Stone Magazine, ask you to write his biography, huge kind of moment for me. I was incredibly flattered and blown away. At the same time, I knew who Jan Wenner was, and he was a character who was known in the magazine business as being kind of piratical and, you know, mercurial, people say. And so I was worried about it, and I went into kind of a protracted negotiation with him about how it would work, not over that lunch, but over the course of about a month, because I was very worried. He did two previous attempts at the book had failed for various reasons, and he's a controlling guy. And so I was concerned about having the book be independent. To me, that was the core of the thing. I was like, if I can get, I knew there was so much opportunity in the story. It's an incredible story. If I could do it independently, I knew I could get it. But if he was going to insist it was authorized, I couldn't. I knew that. And plus, I wasn't going to sacrifice my career on an authorized biography, because typically they're terrible, right? So in this case, we got to the point where we arrived and he we actually had to, you know, came down to a contract with lawyers, and we came to an agreement, and it worked, and, you know, God bless him, he pulled the trigger and took a big risk, and so did I, and, you know, my feeling is that the book is a huge kind of legacy for him. I think he will eventually come to appreciate it.
The comment that he has made, as reported by the New York Times, is that the final product is deeply flawed and tawdry. And as you say, you hope that he will come to understand that there's more to it or not. And even in the reporting in the Times of saying, of asking the question of whether Jan Wenner can see it or not, that you have been able to get and to understand this guy, but it seems as though you would agree to this, which is that you wouldn't have been able to get what you got without that initial connection
agreement
with him. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's no doubt about it. I mean, even with the agreement, you know, after 3.5 years of working on it, when I finished a manuscript, he was, you know, he kind of campaigned to get me to show him the manuscript before I even turned it into the publisher. And you could see him getting nervous about it and starting to get, you know, to be Jan Wenner. And that was sort of the gauntlet, the final gauntlet I had to pass through, is like, no, you know, telling this guy no, saying that I can't do that. You know, this is the moment where if this book's going to be real, you've got to let me do this. And, you know, that was a very kind of dramatic moment in the whole process. And I knew it was make or break. And I knew I was never going to show it to him anyway. And I, you know, whether it was going to be contentious or not was up to him. And he, you know, he let it go. He said, okay. And so the book came out.
Do you believe that he has read it from cover to cover?
You know, it's funny. I don't know. But somebody told me, you know, one early report that I got, let's put it that way, is that he didn't even finish it, you know, basically threw it across the room before he got past the first couple of chapters. So it's hard to know. I mean, I'd be surprised if he hadn't, but it's possible.
When did you start to see what the trouble areas were going to be as far as the parts of his life that would be difficult for you to do your job properly, or how you saw it to be properly?
Well, the primary kind of bottleneck here for him was his sexuality. You know, he was a closeted man for 27 years. You know, I'm talking 27 while married to a woman. And he was, during that time, the editor of Rolling Stone magazine, and which was you know, decidedly not a gay magazine. And in a way, I thought that tension, that whole kind of undercurrent, has to be explored in the book. And he agreed, you know, in theory, yes, that had to be explored, but he was worried about how much of that was going to come out and what, you know, form it would take. And he didn't want a lot of his anonymous partners exposed and these kinds of things. And I didn't, you know, that wasn't my intent, but I did know that the marriage to his ex-wife was like very important to the book, because not only was she his wife, her family had put up the money to get Rolling Stone off the ground, and there was something of a Faustian bargain in their marriage, and I wanted to figure out what that meant. The other thing was is that the ex-wife, Jane Wenner, very instrumental, her name should be known along with his, frankly. You know, she was very important to the success of Rolling Stone magazine, and she was unknown. You know, she'd very rarely spoken in public, and that was going to be, you know, right at the start, Jan Wenner also told me, oh, she'll take more credit than she deserves. And, you know, his ego is such that he really wanted it to be about him and to be his version of his life. Obviously, people like him will want that, right? But so this was going to be difficult to tread.
In reading the book itself, what you get is the stories from these incredible stars of music and of rock and roll who are telling you their stories. And in most, if not all, but in most cases, that they have an axe to grind with this guy. And in some way, they feel that they were treated badly by him, which I find interesting in its own right, but then also interesting knowing what you as the biographer are going through.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, there's some kind of like poetry there about, you know, that. I mean, listen, nobody had asked these rock stars, Paul McCartney, Mick Jagger, Jackson Brown, you know, the list goes on, about this subject. And, you know, a lot of them had just sort of had all these stories tucked away that nobody really ever asked them about. You know, usually people ask them about their own rock careers, but hey, how about the coverage? You know, how about your relationship to the gatekeeper of your story? You know, which was Jan Wenner, who's Rolling Stone, who was going to make or break you back in the 70s or the 80s or whenever you were coming out. What was that like? And so that's a whole thread that not many people had explored or asked them about. And it's, you know, anytime you have somebody like who's an arbiter, like Jan Wenner, you're going to get a lot of strong feelings because these people, you know, their ink was important to them, especially when they were trying to sell a new record. And so there was more emotion there than I had even suspected when I started this project. And, you know, of course, some of these relationships Jan had were like partnerships, really. You know, like with Mick Jagger, you know, the name that they shared, the Rolling Stones and Rolling Stone magazine, which, you know, on the surface might have just seemed some coincidence that, or some, you know, confusion that people had. Well, that confusion and coincidence turns out informed their relationship. And so all of this was like incredibly revelatory to me and, you know, ends up forming a lot of the narrative in the book.
The name of the book is Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine. It's published by Knopf. Joe Hagen is the author who is our guest this morning. Talk a little bit about the John Lennon betrayal, and because in a way that kind of crystallizes relationships, doesn't it? Or his pattern of relationships.
Well, very kind of serendipitously, really, when I at the outset of this project, when I got access to Wenner's archive, I was asked, I said, well, I have to write a book proposal. And I said, I'll just pick one rock star that Jan may have had a relationship with, look at the correspondence, look at the kind of an interview him about it. And I picked John Lennon. Well, it turned out to be kind of incredible in a story anyway. And John Lennon was sort of the first cover of Rolling Stone and was the rock star on whom Jan built the magazine's reputation. And, you know, he had a kind of hand-in-glove relationship to the guy. He worshipped him. He worshipped the Beatles. You know, you can imagine, late 60s, John Lennon, he's the guy. And of course, Wenner wanted to know him and be with him and publish him in Rolling Stone. Well, he does, and he gets the biggest interview really ever with John Lennon in 1970, 71. And, you know, it's the exit interview of John Lennon talking about what it was like to be in the Beatles, right? And afterwards, Jan is going to, once says, wow, this has made international news. This is a huge coup. He tries to publish it as a book. He even wants to publish it as a record, in fact, of the audio. And Lennon says, no, you know, I heard a lot of people with that interview. It's a one-shot deal. And by the way, I own it. That was the handshake deal he had with Jan Wenner. I own that interview. So you just got to publish it. Well, Jan Wenner, in that moment of 1971, decides he's going to override John Lennon, and he publishes the book anyway. It's called Lennon Remembers, which has been reprinted many times over the years. And Lennon was infuriated that Wenner had betrayed him. You know, he thought that Jan Wenner was his number one fan, right? And he never saw Jan Wenner again. They never saw each other again. And so in that anecdote, I saw, oh, there's the two sides of my character. He loves these guys. He worships them. He seduces them. And then, you know, there comes a moment where it's, you know, it's the rock star or him, and he chooses him. And there's like kind of a betrayal moment. He did betray him. And this turns out to have been a theme in Jan's life. Further, and which was extraordinary to me, that his name, Jan, J-A-N-N, his mother, in his baby book, you know, was asked, you know, there's a kind of generic question, why did you name the child Jan? She named him after Janus, she says, you know, the god of two heads, gatekeeper of heaven, she writes. And I thought, this is just extraordinary. I mean, what an incredible, weird, you know, almost like invents the guy out of with his name. And he kind of takes on, he gets this reputation in his life as well. And so anyway, the John Lennon story becomes the, kind of crystallizes everything, and that's why it's the, in the prologue of the book, it kind of establishes the character.
And also, then when Lennon is shot and killed, the reaction by Jan Wenner and the reaction that the magazine takes says a lot as well, and it's really one of the most self-revealing moments that he had in his life, don't you think?
Absolutely. Well, it came at a time. It was 1980, December 1980. It was kind of the timing of it could not have been, again, like extraordinary kind of dark poetry to the whole thing. I mean, it was the end of the 70s, really, like technically the end of what had been thought of as the 70s. The rock and roll world had kind of become decadent and kind of was waning in its kind of cultural centrality. Jan had become kind of a little more drugged out than, you know, it was at the peak of all the drugs. And, you know, Ronald Reagan had just been elected. And people were thinking, you know, Rolling Stone has kind of lost its meaning. Rock and roll isn't sort of providing us with the kind of nutrients it did in the 60s. It doesn't feel the same way it did. Then Lennon is shot. And, you know, that's that issue, that famous issue of John Lennon nude wrapped around Yoko Ono by Annie Leibovitz was published the first month of Reagan's presidency. And it's this incredible moment where everything comes to, you know, is brought back to, you know, I talk about Jan, you know, sort of the two sides of him kind of all kind of collapsing back into himself, back to the beginning of his magazine. It was like, oh, what do we mean? And in a way, the death of John Lennon returned him to the meaning of the magazine. And it gives Jan this chance to redeem himself, you know, to find this sort of karmic sort of balance in his life, and he makes that issue really one of the most extraordinary issue of Rolling Stone ever published. When Annie Leibovitz, who took that cover picture, she called that the photograph of my life.
Right.
And, you know, what a powerful thing.
There are so many questions that I have, but let me try to winnow them down to two or three in the time that we have left. One, of course, is you make this point, and I think it's a really interesting one and an important one, which is that here is a guy who has a huge ego, who is ultimately trying in the business of rock and roll to harness huge egos.
Yes.
And that does not always work out for the best.
Yeah, right. Well, as I got into this, one of the things I realized that I had to do to make this book successful and to make it authentic and real was to kind of like carve back some of the nostalgia and hagiography that had sort of, you know, built up over the, on the 60s and the 70s. And this time, you know, listen, I love this music as much as anybody. I mean, I'm a huge music fan. But I also, as I looked into the archives and did the interviews, I realized, you know, this is a world of, like, ambition. This was a world of people that were trying to become famous rock stars and make a lot of money and you know, be at the center of the culture. And it was at a time when rock and roll was at its peak. And so it was this egos, right? So Jan, who's the gatekeeper of all of their fame, you know, the cover of the Rolling Stone, wow, that puts him in kind of like this kind of intention with his subjects. And all of them are kind of engaging in these battle of wills and betrayals, and it's a soap opera, you know? That's what I began to realize this whole thing. It was like, listen, this is like five seasons of Mad Men times 10, you know? I mean, this is like, it's all the same kind of like incredible drama of the times. It takes you into what it feels like to have been there and how kind of messy the whole thing was and not necessarily glamorous all the time. And so, to me, the ego reveals, as it were really important to the realism of the book.
You pretty much portray Jan Wenner as a pioneer of this age of narcissism that we're living in right now.
Yeah. I mean, that was part kind of a revelation to me through the course of doing the book. But I mean, I really thought about this originally when I was thinking about the prevalence of the Polaroid in the 1970s.
Right.
You know, the first instant Polaroid camera came out in the early 70s, and Annie Leibovitz and Andy Warhol and all these people took to it. And another photographer named John Pagazzi, who's kind of a celebrity photographer, kind of pioneered the selfie. You know, he would take a camera and turn it back on himself, put his arm around a celebrity, and snap the photo. And I said, oh, these guys were kind of, that's when it sort of first was occurring to me that, and then I looked at the covers of Rolling Stone, of course, and it's all these sort of preening rock stars. You began to realize, oh, these guys helped us understand how we could be like this. Right. I mean, if you look at any Facebook page or any Instagram, right, it's so baked into the culture now. It's so well understood how one displays oneself and how one presents oneself and the urge to display oneself. You know, somebody asked me, what would be the cover of Rolling Stone nowadays? And I said, you know, like your Facebook page, right? Everybody's their own cover of the Rolling Stone now because the internet leveled everything. And furthermore, you know, Jan Wenner, besides Rolling Stone, he also published Us Weekly. You know, Us Weekly was how he really made a lot of money, probably more money in like 5 years on Us Weekly than he ever made on Rolling Stone since the beginning. I mean, it was a lot of money.
Right.
And what did Us Weekly do? It kind of like reinvented celebrity around the reality TV culture. Flash forward to last year, I was writing the end of this book while Trump was campaigning and becoming president of the United States. And at first, I just like, how does this make sense? But then a lot of people started calling me, including old friends of Jan's, sort of saying, hey, you know, I'm looking at Donald Trump and hearing what he's saying. And it's not the politics of it, but just the way he presents himself and his ego and his sort of bluntness. And they were all saying, wow, that reminds me of Jan. In many ways, I see parallels between these two. And I don't think, you know, Jan Wenner is politically diametrically opposed to Donald Trump, but only in as much as Donald Trump believes in anything. And I guess my final revelation in the book, for me anyway, is that fame and celebrity decoupled from ideas over the course of the last 50 years, that the arc of the culture was that fame and celebrity trumped everything. And Donald Trump is kind of like this, you know, creation, this monster of the celebrity culture. And Jan Wenner, for good or ill, was, you know, part of that. I'm not saying he was the cause of it, of course, but, you know, he pioneered some of the expressions of celebrity that we know today.
So when I was a teenager, I got my first subscription to Rolling Stone, and I've been a subscriber ever since. I turned 50 at the end of this year. So the magazine has changed dramatically, obviously, from what you write about extensively, from what it was.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, this is anecdotal, of course, but I think you point to this in the book is that many of us still, we want to read it, right? We still, even though the magazine has changed, it still fulfills a need for many of us who are interested in music and in politics and the culture of this country.
Right. Well, here's what I'll say. I mean, that's the power of a brand. It's also the power of the fact that it's 50 years old, and the biweekly narrative of Rolling Stone is like a lifeline to a value system, right, and a worldview. I mean, like Hugh Hefner was to Playboy, Jan Wenner in Rolling Stone is the expression of Jan Wenner's worldview, and it's the expression of the 60s as a kind of font of endless, you know, virtue, really. You know, I mean, in the book I say the hymn book of the 1960s. I mean, this music is meaningful to people. And in a way, when you pick up a copy of Rolling Stone, you're expected to be brought in to the latest chapter of that 50-year story. And it's a story that's still going, although it is arriving to kind of a resting place right now as Jan prepares to try to sell it.
And that inevitably brings up the question, which is when a person of Jan Wenner's stature has been at the helm of a magazine for 50 years, how it goes on, slash, can it go on without him?
Well, I'm somebody who is skeptical that Rolling Stone can have the same meaning when it is sort of decoupled from it, or sort of, you know, removed, when the founder and his worldview is removed. I mean, to me, and what the case I make in the book is that Rolling Stone has always been Jan's magazine. It's his yearbook. It's his worldview. It's his social calendar. And when you take that away, you have a brand. Now, you could reinvent that brand and do any number of things. They could make a music app of it, out of it. You know, and people will know what it means because they'll see Rolling Stone. Oh, music. That means music. But, you know, the long tail of the history and the cast of characters that built Rolling Stone and built what it means, it will be disconnected from that. And I don't think that it can really have the same meaning. It'll be a niche thing and not, you know, as powerful, certainly. And, you know, that speaks to me to Jan Wenner's power and to, you know, the legacy that he leaves. I mean, that, you know, that magazine may not survive without him says something about him.
The book is endlessly fascinating, and my God, you know, you could spend 20 minutes on any story in this book. It's really incredible. Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine. The book is published by Knopf. Joe Hagen, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Sticky Fingers, published by Knopf, by Joe Hagen. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.